Welcome to the Education Pre-Hospital Care Research Forum Journal Club. Here in our PCRF Journal Club, we promote evidence-based practices by critically evaluating the latest science in emergency medical services. We hope our discussion will help advance EMS practice. Through the generous support of our sponsor, Limmer Education, we can make science more accessible and understandable. Hi, everyone. Welcome to the December 2025 Pre-Hospital Care Research Forum Education Research Journal Club. The PCRF promotes research literacy to advance the science of EMS educational research and clinical practice. Here with the PCRF Journal Club, we take a closer look at some of the latest research happening in medical education. Thank you to Limmer Education for sponsoring these podcasts so we can bring you the best of science in education. I'm Megan Corey, and I'm here with Michael Caduce, Alex Tremblay, almost Dr. Alex Tremblay, and Dr. Kim McKenna. And today we're going to bring you the best of education research in 2025, in our opinions. So thank you all for joining us today. Let's begin. We're going to remind you that you can use the chat feature on your screen to type in the questions and comments and maybe some of your favorite research that you can include in the chat in of 2025 related to education, and we can bring those into the conversation as we go. Now, look what we have done since in 2025. We've done a lot. And actually, this is our YouTube page for the Education Research Journal Club. You can find all of this if you go to YouTube and you look us up at PCRF at UCLA, or you can search PCRF Journal Clubs, and you'll find both the clinical and the education research monthly recordings. So check us out, especially now, if you're a faculty out there and you are maybe starting a break, especially if you're in an institution like a college or university, you might be starting your winter break. And if you're like me, you're getting sick right away. And then you can spend some time listening to some prior journal clubs. So in 2025, though, the PCRF sponsored research summits, some with specific topic focus like ventilation, trauma, and health equity, plus summits that were focused on using ESO data, a national data set that connects pre-hospital care to hospital outcomes, as well as data from Image Trend, state-level data. We had the NEMSIS focus data set summit. So a lot going on in 2025 and more to come in 2026. But we also ran journal clubs. We ran one live at AccreditCon in May when we examined research from the collaboration between the National Registry and the COA EMSP that tied together program resource data with trends in student outcomes. And this work continues, so expect more of that in 2026. Then most recently, we were at EMS World Expo, and we broadcast the oral abstract presenters in the education research as our October monthly journal club. So that's a great listen. You can hear the four abstract presenters. Also, all of these abstracts will be published in the supplement edition, in January's edition of the pre-hospital emergency care. So check that out. Now, we also discussed so many articles in 2025 that you don't see up here, but there. And so each one of us, how do we do this best of? Well, each one of us either looked back at the year in what we discussed, or maybe had something that we didn't actually pull in, because we look at a lot of research and decide on topics based on maybe what we haven't talked about before, or something that's timely, or we think that one might be interesting to EMS educators out there. So there were a few that I know we're going to go individually and go through our pick for this best of. And I would highlight a couple that I was close to picking, but I would just say go back and listen to a couple of practical ones that I would recommend. And I'm going to encourage our other panelists to bring up maybe a few that they really enjoyed or thought might be really important or recommend revisiting. One was the February Journal Club. And this was Michael Caduce was our own panelist here. He was the author of this closing the loop, how EMS providers view hospital outcome data. That was our discussion on micro learning. And Michael, I'm wondering if you can come on for just a second, because this that one was such a great practical study of connecting, you know, the real-time data feedback to the pre-hospital providers, and then getting their opinion about how it impacted their care. Is that correct?
Exactly. So if you took a patient to the hospital, the ESO data exchange would allow you to go back and look at your patient's outcome to see if you thought it was a stroke, was it truly a stroke? And then you could get CE from that. So there's your micro learning, because there's evidence that does suggest that checking your outcomes does include learning. Physicians do this with things like UpToDate. So we surveyed providers and said, do you want this? Ironically, like, there's never been a large scale that has asked providers if they want to see their patient outcomes, despite the fact I think most of us probably do know that we do want to see them. So we looked at that, got their perceptions, which were very interesting, because it wasn't exactly what we thought. We thought, like, people want to get smarter. Actually, they want to build their confidence, which are both really important when we look at experience learning theory. So that was nice. And then, yeah, we turned it on and let them survey them again and said, did it help you? Did it work? How many people went through and actually got CAPS-C CE for it? You could get 15 minutes for each one. And then there's been some continued work in this area to look at, okay, now that you have it, how are you using it? What are you using it for? I envision a day when we could say, you don't need to do any stroke CEs this year because you identified properly, whatever preset record we have. You identified 5 of 5 strokes in the last 2 months, so you don't need to do any CE on it, right? As opposed to this sort of model where everybody does the exact same CE topics, irrelevant of your actual true need. Or it says, hey, you failed to identify 4 of the last 5 strokes. It's probably time to do some refresher training there. So.
Yeah, very practical. And also, I remember thinking of two things there. One was it informs policy. So if the state has a policy, like I know in California, and this is where your study was done, I think that it has to be at least an hour or something to be CE. And these were micro learning. So there's evidence to actually take this to policy and say, you know what, you need to change that policy because you're impeding progress here if we're actually getting some learning out of it. The other thing that we pulled out of it is, what's your next step? I mean, obviously the next step would be to measure, does it actually improve or change practice? So what is, you know, have you thought about that part of it yet?
So it's now currently running. So if you are work for an ESO agency that has the HDE, the put through of the calls, you do the CE. We do have some targeted questions running for folks that get the CE to see what they're like. Why are you doing it, right? Like, are there certain calls that people do go? We recognize you probably don't go look at every call, right? But why are you looking at the calls that you're looking at? I think that continues to drive what we need. So yeah, I think those are the things that we want to keep asking and saying, does this value, does this help, right? Again, I think it's easy to say, like, of course it does, but no one's actually looked at that. So yeah, I think that's the next step, is to see how is this helping providers? How can we continue to design it? Right now, the throughput is only things that are documented by the hospital clinician, but maybe the future is more than just what was the ICD-10 code, what was the hospital diagnosis, and what were they discharged to? Did they go back to their home? Did they go back to their care center? But, what procedures were performed in the emergency department? What labs were drawn, right? I think that can help dictate some of the care that we're doing in the pre-hospital setting. So, yeah, I think that's one of the other things that we're actively working on.
Great. Kim.
Well, I loved this because, you know, the National Registry is working on a continued competence agenda for the future. And so, kind of thinking about what are the alternative and perhaps more effective ways, as Brooke Burton put in the chat, you know, she thinks maybe micro learning is even more effective.
Yes.
And, you know, being able to connect it in a really meaningful way to their patient care, I think is really huge. What surprised me was that so few took advantage of the continuing education option in the beginning, because maybe they thought, well, 15 minutes, that's, but if you were, you know, it's like right now, so many people wait to the last minute and just like do this bolus of education. And,
Air
you know,
quotes
I
for
think what's really going to be important is to try and encourage people to be integrating the education kind of within their everyday to be able to really make it
Absolutely.
more meaningful. So well done.
Absolutely. Well, thank you. And I think it taught us to logistics and getting CE has to be as easy as possible, right? We used agencies, so very few people actually got their CE hours out of it compared to how many looked at the outcomes. And we learned some things, right? These agencies already provide the CE, so there's a chance these people don't need the CAPC CE, but they still want to see the outcome. And the other thing is, it took steps to get the CAPC CE. You had to register yourself and everything like that. So as we look at future development of systems that do this, we need to make them integrated as much as possible. So that folks just sort of it's like when you go take ACLS and you put in your stuff, it just automatically pops up at the National Registry, right? I think as we look to that ease of technology, that's really probably where we should be focused.
And it seems like the continuing education would be a really meaningful way to get people to really reflect on what they did, what they saw, how they might improve, which, as we know, is like a critical piece in learning how to get better and move from novice to
Yes.
expert in any profession.
And I
People
think that,
are, oh, go ahead,
go
Mike.
ahead, mate. I think that begs the question of like, should we put together like a post review questionnaire, right? Did this go as you thought it was? And that's what we ask these providers. But as you look again at the larger scale of people learning from their outcomes, I think we have to be asking, like, should we make them do something afterwards? Again, a simple reflection or journal or something. In order to get the CE, you need to write a short reflection that no one will ever see, right? But you still need to do it.
Except researchers, maybe,
Yeah, there you go.
who
So
can
for sure.
collect
We're gonna
it.
de-identify it all and read it. Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah, I don't know. But Kim's spot on. Like there has to be something that drives you just to look at it and be like, oh yeah, I got it right. Or like, no, I didn't get it right. But both of those have learning opportunities.
I think people are hungry for meaningful continuing education. And it's interesting. I think you had said Burton was on. I believe it was it may have been or Stephanie Ashford that did the rapid cycle deliberate practice study, which is another very practical study. We didn't look at it on the Journal Club, but I just remember that presentation at one of the conferences. And meaningful continuing education, I think, is really important. That was the other study that I actually wanted to highlight that I didn't choose, but I was on the fence about choosing it. And that was, I would strongly recommend listening to Dr. Ayanna Walker, who spoke with us in August on her study on the Pit Crew card game, a gamifying continuing education. And this was one that was in the International Journal of Emergency Medicine that and having Dr. Walker on was just a great thing to actually walk us through her process and walk us through the process of training at their agency in Florida. And it was just a that was a really good session. So I would recommend kind of going back to that. And again, it's called the Pit Crew Card Game, a novel gamification exercise to improve EMS performance in critical care scenarios, part of continuing education again. But I had to choose one, and I did not choose one that was like super practical. I went by my interest area, and I did select one that I thought was kind of a 30,000 foot view. But I thought it was really important because, and when we look at the articles that each of us pick, there is sort of an overarching theme of faculty preparation, faculty onboarding, training of new instructors, because we know that turnover in career and technical education is an issue, right? So this was called Addressing CTE Faculty Shortages in Community Colleges, Perspectives from the Field. It was in a journal called the CTE Journal, Career and Technical Education. So it looked broadly at career and technical education. This particular study looked at outcomes in North Carolina, but it came from a national survey of CTE personnel, program personnel at community colleges. And this was, and by program person or personnel, I mean there were some administrators, mostly faculty, over 600 survey returns. And then in North Carolina, you can reduce that to a little over, I think it was 170 or something like that. And they looked at things, they used theories that I hadn't heard of before reading this. I'm sure Alex has heard of these because you've done some workforce research at job embeddedness theory and Hertzberg's two-factor theory that look at motivators, like intrinsic motivators, like achievement, recognition, meaningful work that promote job satisfaction with what they call hygiene factors, which are salary, workload, and policy that prevent dissatisfaction but don't directly promote satisfaction. That's something I hadn't heard of before. I thought it was interesting. And they looked at job embeddedness theory related to retention factors, like why do people stay? Rather than why do people leave and what's the source of burnout, we always are sort of on the negative perspective. They also looked at why people stay. And these were three dimensions, like social and professional, fit, like mission alignment, and then the sacrifice cost of leaving. And asked, these questions that were basically, of these personnel as to what the what were the driving factors? And this was decide it was to inform hiring and onboarding and skill development. And it stood out to me because I've noticed the trend. We can hire and hire and hire. And by the way, the hiring process sometimes is not that easy at a college. Also, takes a lot of time. People don't get extra pay for being on a hiring committee. It's and then they, when you do hire, the person has to come on. They have to onboard. And then they got onboard in their specific area. And maybe their idea of teaching was, I'd like to come in and impart my wisdom, and then I'd like to go home. And really what we always call it administrative tasks, but they're really not administrative. They're part of teaching and learning. So learning outcomes, evaluation, grading, and reporting your class list at at the census date and those kind of things are often considered like administrative when they're really kind of part of teaching and learning. But people don't know this when they come in. And so I think that is a source of issue. So what I did like, and this was just one of those diagrams, they developed this figure out of this. And if you start from the outcomes and work backwards, this in the little purple square there, what we really want is faculty stability, reduced vacancies, instructional quality, and then alignment with the workforce needs. So the interesting part of this is they looked at all types of workforce needs, and there's one table in here that identified what are the areas in your college or in your institution that have the most vacancies and the most problems with retaining faculty. And it was healthcare came up as number one by a long shot. I mean, there's a whole list of different, there's construction and trades and IT and engineering and, all kinds of other ones. And the top four were the ones where you do tend to see people in industry that, maybe have higher pay. There's more, commitment to the industry. But the healthcare came out as the highest. The shortages were concentrated in high demand, high skill technical fields, healthcare, skilled trades, and tech. And those happen to also be the wage gap between teaching and practice is pretty wide. So that is a I thought that was interesting. That's a national set. So we can see, what North Carolina did was they gleaned the data for their state so that it would help inform their practices internally and where, funding flow, where are they going to spend their most money in terms of improving faculty stability, reduced vacancies, instructional quality, and workforce alignment. And so then you see all these things that are levers, and we have the organizational levers, but, the desire to be mentored and to be included in institutional leadership and decision making. And then the attractors are student impact. I mean, people don't go into education for the money. Not to say they wouldn't stay a little longer if they got paid more, but they don't go into education for the money. It's for, student impact, a little bit of recognition of making an impact. And then, advancement opportunities, of course. Then reducing the barriers and compensation, workload, bureaucracy, and again, all of the things they didn't expect to in advancement all were factors. So I thought this was, I chose this because I thought it had important data that helps inform hiring and onboarding and institutional planning. And then I also picked it because right after we did this, I thought it was such an important study that I called my CTE dean and said, you know what, do you want to do a journal club on career and technical ed in our spring 26 mid-semester flex day, which is our professional development day. And here's an article I thought was really interesting, and maybe we could pick a couple of them and have a CTE faculty journal club. And he thought it was a great idea, so we actually are going to do that in the spring. So I thought it was a really a important article that I will resonate with CTE faculty across the board. It'll also pull us all together, so we're not off too much in our silos like we usually are, you know, commiserating about our own things when we actually have a lot of things in common. So that was my pick, and I don't know if you guys had any, if you remember this one, but that was my pick for the year 2025. So next up, we've got Michael Caduceus's pick. So Michael, tell us what this one is about. This was not from one of our journal clubs.
Absolutely. And I would just comment on like, I'm glad to hear that there's other educators that recognize that like we don't get paid very much. So, or the rest of the community recognizes educators don't get paid as much. So that's that was interesting. So, I was looking for just through some different articles, and I am a big fan of JSEP Open, so just started looking through their stuff. And I'd seen this come up when it got published, and I don't even remember that I read it. And then it came back up again, and I was like, ooh, this uncertainty tolerance thing is something we do a ton of in emergency medicine. And in my mind, it was interesting because it's sort of an oxymoron to be like uncertainty of certain, or there is a certainty of uncertainness that comes with emergency medicine. And so they studied this. So this group of researchers interviewed medical school faculty and instructors about a level of uncertainty that comes with healthcare and especially emergency medicine. So if you think about it, the amount of information you're taking in, there's a great deal of uncertainty when doing patient care, right? Is the information you're getting accurate? Is it full, right? Well, we have these meds, but there's some other meds, and these are my symptoms, but I don't really feel comfortable sharing all of that when I walk into the emergency department. So you're in EMS and in emergency medicine, which is what they describe, we deal with a large amount of uncertainty, and that can drive either fear of paralysis, right? Analysis by or paralysis by analysis. So we don't do anything because we're so worried that there's not something there. Or we swing to the other side of the spectrum, which is it's a very algorithmic teaching, sort of like I think like an ACLS call, right? Oh, I do this and I do this and I do this, and at the end of the day, the patient survives, and there's really no deviation for certain. Like everything in the scenario is certain. You're giving everything that you need to run the call, where we know in the field that's oftentimes not the case. So they surveyed providers following a full day of simulation and surveyed them using this uncertainty rubric and then some open-ended questions. So let me get to where I highlighted this. Their survey included some demographic factors, but then there's an intolerance of uncertainty scale that actually exists that they utilize before, and then went through all of their open-ended questions on, you know, what did they want? And so they came up with four themes, and some of the themes are what I thought was really interesting. So the four themes were confidence through exposure, safety fosters engagement, growth from insight, and then navigating ambiguity with flexible learning. And I noted just a few things that I think are takeaways for us as educators and things we can incorporate into our classrooms. And these are mostly from what the folks said that they interviewed with their open-ended questions. So, one person said, if you're not willing to accept uncertainty, you're at a high state of stress at all times because your mind is always trying to predict everything that can happen. So, again, there has to be some acceptance of uncertainty and some action that comes from this uncertainty. They also noted that you have a much higher stress level if you're constantly unable to make these decisions based on uncertainty. Like, well, we don't know, so we have to test everything. We have to do all these images, where sometimes we have to operate with this level of uncertainty, but we're still going to make a decision to provide patient care. Establishing psychological safety emerges foundational to helping individuals tolerate and navigate uncertainty. So again, I think putting students into simulations that somehow bridge the spectrum from the ACLS very straightforward mega code to the sort of no-win scenario where you're just set up to fail. I think sort of finding a happy medium there, maybe more towards the uncertain side, but again, students still have to be safe. They have to know there's an outcome that's coming. Competence means different things. You can have two different people with two different approaches and both be competent. And this was through their diversity of thought and acceptance as variable. So working together, but recognizing that like your solution and my solution may both be right. And we struggle with the students all the time. It's like, no, tell me what's going to be on the test. And you're like, it's actually like both of those are reasonably correct. So they brought this all back to a couple of theories, which I thought were that we've discussed and had some comments about. So this perception aligns with experiential learning theory, which emphasizes the role of concrete experiences and reflection. So putting students into these environments where they experience routinely having to be uncertain about something or the entire call in general is again that exposure part. We have to put them into scenarios where there is uncertainty, where they don't have all the answers. And then they also put it with adaptive expertise theory, and they like this where this is the theory where things are can be routine and that's good, but then also we have to put ourselves into opportunities where we have knowledge flexibility and complex cases which require us to sort of stretch our mental muscles a little bit. So I thought that was really nice. Yeah, it's just an interesting study on sort of this topic that we have to have some uncertainty tolerance in EMS and in emergency medicine. And they actually did some studying on it and said these are some of the foundational principles. Some of these things we probably do in our classrooms already, and some of these are opportunities for us to do more of. It's also in JSIP Open, so it's free.
I put the tool that they used in the chat too, if anybody wants to read it. It's very interesting. It's 27 questions, which I don't know is ever a short scale. But I wanted to echo some of what Michael said about this article because I really enjoyed it as well. Working in data, uncertainty is this thing that we have to talk about all the time, right? Like, yeah, we review every single call, but that call could have happened a million times and not 30. And then what happens, right? And there's no such thing as an accurate micrometer. If you hold two rulers next to each other, one of the rulers is going to be off, those kinds of things. And like we have to teach people all the time when we talk about improving our guidelines or we talk about improving our clinical education, like we're basing this off of data that is in of itself within a margin of error of 5%, right? 2.5% on either side or whatever. And what really stood out to me about this is like I have always found it, in my 16 years that like the uncertainty is the best part of the job. I really enjoy having no idea what's going to come next because if I knew what was going to come next, I probably wouldn't want to do it, right? Like if I say, oh, you're going to go to a bad rec, like I don't want to do that. So I think it's really interesting to take that time in education to say like it's okay, like it's kind of cool to drop somebody off and never hear about what's going to happen again. So I thought this article was really compelling in that
Yeah.
direction.
In my mind, Alex, I think that's a teaching component too, of like part of this job is uncertain, but you have to take that into the call too, right? We have no idea what we're going to next, but you also, once you get there, you have no idea what's potentially going on inside of this patient's body, right? With the limited information you have. And that has to be, you have to be okay with that when you enter this industry. And that's what builds. They note in this article a lot about resiliency and how having a high level of stress of over uncertainty, which would equate to a low tolerance of uncertainty, right, increases your risk of high stress, which increases your risk of burnout. So having more tolerance for uncertainty increases your resiliency. And if we're truly trying to prepare people to be in this business for forever, we have to do that. And there are some simple ways to do it. They note several times of requiring a student to give three differential diagnoses so they don't anchor to one of them, right? There's some uncertainty that comes with this, so you have to have an open mind of what could be wrong with the patient and remove yourself from that anchoring bias. So, just a really interesting article.
It really sounds like I took just sort of a glance, but do you think some of this is about getting comfortable being uncomfortable?
Nailed it. I think that's like the number of cliches we could come up with to describe some of the things that they discuss in here is truly like, again, it's the level of uncertainty or your tolerance of uncertainty, getting uncomfortable with or being comfortable with being uncomfortable. Yeah, I think all those things fit this. And again, the nice part about this is they've got so many interview notes of what people said. It's really quite easy then to, I think, drive some of those into our current practices.
Yeah. And Advanced Medical Life Support has a great tool for evaluating, and has for some time on, kind of forcing students to list differential diagnoses beyond. It's actually something my medical director, I could echo him, which is, broaden your differentials, broaden your, yes, you can drill down on that one, but I want to hear what else could it be? Because it'll drive your assessment. If suddenly you say, well, I guess it could be sepsis. Well, I guess I should check the skin and the lungs and the kidneys, and I should do a physical exam and
It brings you back to the value of like a marker board or a jotter app on the tablet of like, okay, start writing down all the things you think could be wrong, right? And then we'll just start crossing them out as we go.
Yeah, an idea too, Kim. I'd love to hear your opinion on this too. If you can measure then this uncertainty, then we can measure the change, right? We can measure a student who is very uncomfortable, with this idea that I need to that I have to be uncertain about something. Can we measure that their growth in that area over time? And is that an affective evaluation? Well, what is that?
That sort of goes into like all the non-cognitive factors that can influence a student's success. So it would be, you make me think, like, could you measure it like at the very beginning before somebody actually takes the program and see if does it even predict who will be successful? Or even like, I mean, you could, using the EMS ID, you could even follow them through a career. How many people persist in the career because it would be so stressful. I think about one of my kids in particular who does not deal with uncertainty at all, and how stressful that is to not be able to deal with that. But also then to learn what strategies would be most appropriate. And I love the three differentials thing. We use that, and I think I learned it from AMLS too. But I think that is really critically important for teaching clinical judgment.
Great. So do you think, Alex, do you think, and Mike, do you think that tool is useful to measure change? Is that something where you could measure, use that at the beginning, or is there something,
It's a
that's lacking in it?
personality scale. It's a 27 question personality scale where you rate does not describe my personality at all to perfectly describes my personality. So I guess theoretically you could, but I guess you're asking people to change their personality in the moment.
Yeah, well, that's the ultimate affective question, right? Is it personality? Is there areas for growth, which I believe affective, people can grow in the affective domain, but how to measure that is challenging.
And the article argues that this is a teachable skill,
Yes.
right? So I would agree with you. I think we can all attest our personalities change over time, whether that's the 6 months you're in, school or the year you're in school. I don't know, but yeah, the argument from the study is that these are teachable skills.
Yeah, there's one podcast I listen to, and at the end, it's a leadership podcast. He asks the guests, tell me one thing that you've changed your mind about over the last 5 years or whatever, in terms of the leadership philosophies and so on and so forth. And it's really amazing because that really, a lot of those things are affective things, it's really amazing how much some of these leaders in leadership have changed their opinions about things over time as they learn and as they grow.
Growth mindset. I hear growth mindset in there too. Yeah, there's a lot to uncover in that one. Thank you, Michael. All right, so let's move to the next one. And this is Kim's pick. And this one we actually talked about this year. We were all there, and Kim, Dr. Heather Davis came in, and we had a great discussion on this one. Take it away, Kim.
Sure. So this is research that was published in March in the International Journal of Paramedicine by Vitalo. I'm probably just really destroying that name. Full disclosure, I had like worked on a project for NEMC that one of these researchers uncovered. And last year at NEMC, we were sort of talking about, is there a need to revisit simulation for as a research project? So it was a group with people from Society for Simulation and Healthcare and NEMC, and just sort of trying to think, maybe there's a lot of stuff out there. What is it that we still need to know? And so these authors kind of talked about that, at least one dimension of one thing that we had looked at. And so the research questions were, what is the level of research evidence and quality of primary studies investigating simulation-based education as a substitute for a portion of pre-licensure clinical placement hours in medicine? It's a big question. And it's a question that the COA is wrestling with. It's a question that many programs are wrestling with as they increasingly have difficulty competing with clinical space with other health disciplines. And then their second, and so their first question was the only one, spoiler alert, that they were actually able to answer. And then, secondly, what are the measures and outcomes used? And does the evidence demonstrate statistically or clinically significant differences or equivalence for evaluation of outcomes when simulation-based education is substituted for a proportion of paramedic clinical placements? And then, if the evidence supports the use of simulation as a substitute, what is the optimal proportion of simulation hours versus clinical placement hours? In what placement ratio, for what durations, and so on and so forth? And the nurses were able to do some of this, but in a very expensive study, in a very much more uniform environment with appropriate training for faculty, and so on and so forth. So they used an approach. They used the PRISMA guidelines to search the literature and initially found 28 articles, which then they pared down to only three articles that actually addressed any of the research questions that they were looking to answer. And to me, that was like almost the biggest like surprise of the whole thing was like how little research there has been done on this topic, given the fact that it's such an important question, you know, because of our resource limitations, because of the growth in the number of programs, how much can we reasonably substitute? And given the fact that we had COVID and we had to do some substitution, but of course, nobody was in the research frame of mind at that moment, right? We were all just like scrambling to try and do the best that we could. So they evaluated all of the studies, pardon me, for quality. And, you know, the initial quality assessment was good, but basically they're all pretty low level of evidence. The super simulation study was observational, and we did some cross-sectional analysis. And there was a second study by Williams that used DVD simulations. And that was also, they did some cross-sectional analysis of that. And then Kimberly Wittenchung did a qualitative study with semi-structured interviews to look at directors' perceptions of supplementing clinical requirements with simulation-based education. But, you know, the bottom line was that, you know, we asked very general questions about, do you ever substitute simulation for clinical? And if you do, what are you substituting it for? And so many people were substituting it for really, you know, to try and get the isolated clinical skills. And I think Kimberly Wittenchung found this too, when in clinical settings where the students didn't have much opportunity for actual hands-on, they were trying to substitute it in those cases. And so the bottom line was there's really very little known about this. And we know that paramedic programs are substituting, especially paramedic programs. We didn't really specifically ask about EMT programs. But we know that programs are substituting some simulation for clinical hours. And, you know, some of the work that Dave Page and some of the other folks in the FISDAP research summits did actually showed that the number of hours of clinical is not associated with the ability to answer higher level questions on summative examinations. And so I think that, you know, that sort of speaks to the fact that where is the value in clinical? You know, the value in clinical, in my mind, is seeing like the real patient having the real problem. And we can have them practice the actual skills and the hands-on and the interviewing and that sort of thing in simulation. But they need to know what a real birth looks like other than just on a video. They need to know what somebody that is actually going into cardiac arrest looks like, or somebody that's in pulmonary edema, or, you know, so many of the things the sounds, the smells, the feels of a real person having that real problem, I think is really where clinical is a benefit. And so I would love for somebody to take on a project like the nurses did for us to really understand where should we be using clinical and where should we just be using more field, knowing that also some of our field sites don't run very many calls. So, we did look at that as well, but there was much less substitution for field experience. And of course, the COA will only, in the capstone, you definitely cannot substitute. So, yeah.
Yeah, this is a great and it's such a great topic. And I think one of the struggles that we have is this emphasis on hours of replacement rather than on the quality and competencies and the actual.
Yeah.
And I know in some states that there are they actually place hours requirements. And one of the I remember asking somebody, why is everything keep coming down to hours? It doesn't make sense. We keep
Right.
talking about competency and hours. And somebody explained to me because, there are certain agencies that want to pay their people and they need to know how many hours they're going to have to pay. And I said, you're kidding me. That's what this is all about. And that's actually what it is all about. This HR kind of,
Oh my
well, we
gosh.
need to have some semblance of hours. And we know that it's just going to be so variable. Like you said, you're going to have areas where there's not going to be enough calls. There's going to be more concentrated volume in a hospital. But also, speaking of changing your mind, the whole idea of being a fly on the wall, that's what we always called it. Oh, well, how useful is it to be a fly on the wall? I have completely flipped on that because going to labor and delivery, even if you're not in there and delivering the baby, watching how the nurses do it, watching how they handle the baby as it's born, how they, handle postpartum hemorrhage and or control for hemorrhage in a normal delivery, all of that, the handling the cord and just little baby steps in there, even if it's just watching or touching without actually delivering. And then, like you said, you can come back to the simulation lab and we can run it like you're in the field and do it. But they get so much out of seeing those births and seeing how it happens. And yeah, there's video too. I mean, you can, the Global Health Media Project has great labor and delivery videos that are great to show. But there is something about being in that team environment too, and watching the team put things together and how they assess something over time, not just a short video, but the progression of labor or the progression of someone's care in a trauma center. I think there's so many other aspects that might be important.
It's the emotion too. Honestly, when you watch a video, you don't feel the emotion of the moment, of the, watching everybody perform despite the fact that, how people are managing their emotions. And so I think clinical is essential for isolated skills. I'm not going to say it's not, for vascular access and medication administration and the respiratory care, some of those things. I think it's essential, but moving away then from a hours base to the being able to achieve certain competencies, I think would be much more productive when you're looking at clinical. But again, we don't know. And these authors sort of conclude that, it's hard to say substituting isn't helpful. I mean, it's hard to say because there's just not enough evidence out there.
Yeah, and in the student minimum competency matrix in the COA EMSP documentation, the there are patient types, and then there's a little box that will say simulation is acceptable
Right.
for this, and we know that these are things that a student is not likely to be able to demonstrate competency in. Even if they do go to a clinical setting and see it, they're not, likely to be able to, actually demonstrate competency in delivering a baby or whatever. And earlier this year in January, we looked at an article on medical student or medical, I can't remember if it was student or resident, clerkships and the effect on their knowledge base, on cognitive performance. And the three that had the most effect were obstetrics, pediatrics, and psychiatrics. And I thought that was interesting because if you look at data from SMCs, you'll see that those are the areas, OB, and pediatrics and psychiatrics that have That are, and even though people will say, well, we get plenty of psych patients in the ED, they're not pure psych patients unless you're in a, they're actually patients with psychiatric or behavioral disorders that have had some kind of an incident. Usually you'd have to be in a, we're talking about psychiatric in a facility.
Crisis.
Yeah, a
Yeah, they
crisis or a
don't do
crisis
that
unit.
acute crisis
Yep.
behavioral acting out as much
Yeah.
sometimes.
Sometimes, yeah. Probably
But
more and more, but the impact on the cognitive performance was more measurable in those areas than in any of the other areas of the clerkship. So there was, a suggestion that the clerkship was beneficial to their knowledge base. Which is interesting because they're not going to get the even a medical student may not get the hands-on in those settings, but they just being there actually seemed to have impacted their knowledge base, at least in that study. Then last year we also looked at the one that compared four types of continuing education. That was in pre-hospital emergency care. That was an EMS study, and it was the four different way methods of teaching. And if you remember, it was low fidelity simulation, little drills, micro drills that had the greatest impact. The reason I bring those two up is I think there are these loose connections between all of these studies that are pointing us into a direction that says, yes, these are valuable. The clinical is valuable for improvement of knowledge, maybe, and actually the emotion, like you said, maybe measurable by some type of scale to measure the attachment of empathy or emotion or something like that. And then that these low fidelity, drilling kind of simulations may be better for the psychomotor performance, and not just psychomotor performance, but actually running, a full critical care. And it was really focused on critical care. So,
Yeah, there was a
yeah.
group in Australia that just I heard a presentation this woman did about, and they use flat cardboard pictures of patients, sometimes even just a picture of a laryngoscope handle, cardboard cutout of a demented elderly patient walking around with scissors taped onto the cardboard. And she said the thing that did was they were still able to create some of that like psychological fidelity for people by doing these, and much more able to do some in situ simulation on the in the moment, focus on team skills, those kinds of things. So I
Yeah.
think it all depends on what your objectives are always.
Absolutely. And this is another area I think I may have been, I'd love to hear, Michael, your opinion on this too, running simulation. But I've kind of flipped a little bit on when I go to presentations at conferences and they're telling you have to be realistic, you have to have this and you have to have that, and here's how you can do it, and immersive this and the this and that. And I've found it just teaching like a regular CPR class most effective when we just put them in a dark room, turn on rave music, and say, okay, now we're going to run the same little thing here, but you're now in a club and they can't turn off the music. And they just love it. And they're like, oh, this is much more. How am I going to hear the AED? And, at least it makes them think. And I don't know, if it has an impact on their performance, but
Or just going outside,
yeah,
right? Like
going
it's the,
outside.
I find the people that want to do the big fancy things are also the people that are trying to sell me those big fancy
Yeah.
things. But to your point, like there's really not a lot of evidence that says the higher level of fidelity is really changing their performance, at least in the classroom setting. Yeah, I think going outside, I mean, we have mannequins that you have to put a tourniquet on because they actually bleed. Like those things are really quite simple, but I think putting a tourniquet on someone who's actively bleeding, even a mannequin who's actively bleeding, has to have some realistic context. We did a simulation, it was reason this is my head, we did a simulation just the other day, and there was fake blood in the parking lot right behind our building, and we have some staff members from the other building that like to walk laps around our building, and they sent me a note with a photo. They're like, "Is everything okay?" And I was like, "It's fake. It's okay. No big deal. We're just waiting for it to get washed away." But I do think those things, I mean, you put them in a rave music, you put them in an environment where someone's actually bleeding, and all of a sudden you get that like, oh, right? And you're like, yeah. I think you're spot on. I don't know that it's the fancy stuff that matters. I just think it just generally, as we talk about this, I think there's some other evidence too that suggests that clinical is easier true place in the field, or than field, and via simulation. I think that sounds reasonable in my mind. I don't know that I, again, it's all the other stuff, right? Like, yeah, you can start an IV, but can you hold the infant, right? If you're the 18 to 26 year old demographic who's never had kids, then I need you to learn that. I need you to learn how to talk to a pregnant mother who's expecting, like, who's about to deliver this baby with a more compassionate tone that you probably never have. And seeing someone who's done it for 10 years, you pick up on those things, seeing how an anesthesiologist looks at the airway compared to how a brand new paramedic student looks at the airway, right? Those are those things that I really need you grasping that I don't know that you're grasping in simulation.
To your point about the infant too, it is a persistent problem that infants are cold in the field, and warming is not sufficient. And learning how to dry and warm, that the baby is not going to get better unless you warm them. And so that alone, like how to wrap a baby, how to get them warm. It's at the top of the inverted pyramid. Warm that baby. Don't start drilling bones and give an epi for persistent bradycardia when they're hypothermic,
Or hypoxic.
So yeah.
I think, swaddling is not on our skill sheet, but we do have like real baby blankets in all of our OB kits, right? Like not those foil blankets that come with them. Like purchase the cloth blankets and teach your students how to swaddle the kid. Like it's not that hard, but usually there's someone in the class that knows. And I'm like, good, you show them. Do some peer mentoring there. I'll
very
drop
true.
my 3-year-old has learned how to swaddle her babies. I'll drop her off for you.
Yeah, there you go. Actually, that's a really good point. We get older siblings to come in and show people how to swaddle. We went through this with our high school dual enrollment EMT prep class. How to swaddle, and some of them were older siblings, and they already knew. I was like, "Can you come and teach our paramedic students how to do this?" Yeah, great stuff. So, okay, this is all of our review for today. Any final thoughts or comments about? And you can put those in the chat if there's anybody out there who has anything they'd like to see in 2026, also, and where we think we're headed.
I would just say, I think all great articles. We've had a lot of fun over the last year. So thanks for everybody that's attended and been able to put their stuff into the chat. We do know that at the January NAEMSP conference, there is some educational research that has made it into the top 30. So if folks are planning to attend that, please check out NAEMSP in January. That's our next, EMS conference coming up because there will be a great opportunity there to do the poster walk and watch the orals because there's always some good educational components that make those up.
Keep an eye on prehospitalcare.org because there will be, and on we're on LinkedIn as well as Instagram and others. So pay attention to our announcements about upcoming applications for research summits in 2026. Lots of stuff happening at the Prehospital Care Research Forum, and a big thank you to Limmer Education for supporting science in EMS education and for supporting us in these podcasts and other events. And check out a list of our sponsors. Also, we would never be able to do as much as we can without all of the sponsor support for the podcast, for the summits, for all of the Pre-Hospital Care Research Forum activities. Big thank you to our associates also out there and our board members for reviewing abstracts and always being ready to mentor new researchers. So if you're out there and you're thinking, I kind of want to do research, but I don't even know where to begin, go to prehospitalcare.org, start there. We have a huge list of associates that are standing by. So, but join us next year too. Thank you. It's 2026. We're going to be back on January 23rd, Friday. Again, going with the fourth Friday, with a few exceptions like this one, 10 a.m. Pacific, noon Central. And then the next Clinical Journal Club, Dr. Remley Crowe and Dr. Tony Fernandez, Monday, January 12th. To join us live each month, again, you can register directly at prehospitalcare.org. And don't forget to visit our YouTube channel and go listen to some while you're on your break. And please, safe and happy and healthy new year and holiday season to everyone. Thanks for joining. We hope you have enjoyed and learned from this PCRF Journal Club. Please share it with other interested EMS professionals. An archive of past journal clubs can be found at www.pcrfpodcasts.org. You can also find us on Facebook at PCRF at UCLA and on our website at www.prehospitalcare.org. A special thank you to our sponsor, Limmer Education, providing education tools for success at every stage of your EMS journey.